Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo. Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, December 5th, 2011. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And remember that our shows are archived on DrSaputo.com and PRN.FM.
You're going to hear Vicky's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour. Now, we've got another great show for you today that's going to include low HDL cholesterol levels don't cause heart attacks. Now, that's a revolutionary concept.
And here's another surprising thing is that it is unusual for doctors and nurses to wash their hands in patients' rooms.
What's going on there? And the Canadians have got some interesting common sense approach to mammograms. They say don't do so many, don't do self-breast exams, and don't do clinical breast exams. You want to know why? We'll be talking about that.
And food in children's hospitals is unhealthy.
Boy, this is going to be quite a show. And adverse drug reactions in seniors lead to 100,000 emergency room visits and admissions every year.
And 1 in 10 stent patients is readmitted within 10 days with serious outcomes, and much more.
So if you want to join us in our conversation, you have questions about the topics that we're discussing or about your health, give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
You know, medical research sometimes comes out that can blow a hole in our thinking the way medicine is practiced. And what just came out is that it's not the HDL that does the good. A study shows that when it goes up, heart attack rates go down. However, when a genetic defect for making HDL was separated from the group, they didn't have a higher rate of heart attack. So the HDL isn't the problem, and there are probably other factors.
That's really fascinating to me. You know, we know that by association, we've done so many studies, you know, starting with the Framingham Health Study, that showed us that cholesterol is associated with heart disease. But it's also associated with staying alive because you have to have cholesterol. Otherwise, you can't be alive. I mean, it makes vitamin D. It makes a lot of our hormones that we have. It makes healthy cell membranes. It protects us against Alzheimer's disease.
It's just gotten such a bad rap.
It really has. And it's the association that does it. So cholesterol itself is not a bad thing. But it is a reflector. It's a marker, much like a PSA is in prostate cancer when you're looking at HDL. Because when you lower, as Vicky was saying, your HDL level by about 13%, the risk for a heart attack goes up by 18%. So you know that association is correct because many studies have shown it. But in this particular study, what they did is they looked at people who had a low HDL that was caused by a genetic defect. And in those people who were part of this study of about 70,000 people, they showed that, yes, there was an association for the general population, but no, these people who had genetically low HDLs did not have an increased risk for developing a heart attack. That's big news because it turns the paradigm that we've been focusing on its head.
So what about raising the HDL artificially?
Well, it doesn't work. I mean, we've tried that years ago.
Not
with the statins, although the statins do that. But with another family of drugs that only increased HDL. And what they found is there was an all-cause mortality that was higher. So raising HDL that way didn't work. Yet if you raise HDL through exercise and diet and weight reduction, something totally different happens. Then you do reduce your risk for it. So like the prostate-specific antigen, the PSA test, that test is telling you that you're at risk for prostate cancer, but keep a couple things in mind. About 25% of all prostate cancers don't have a high PSA level. And of those that are elevated above the upper limit of normal, which is usually 4, up until about a level of 4 to 15, prostate cancer is probably only present about half the time. So we've got a test there that's a marker, but not the cause of the disease. So if we lowered the PSA level by trying to destroy PSA, it wouldn't do us any good for the cancer. And what this is showing is that HDL, okay, is associated with, but again, not the cause of, or the protection of, heart attacks and strokes. So that's kind of a fascinating concept that I think is news to us.
So I guess what's important is low LDL, and then the vitamin D and the hormones and the cell membranes, that can help, though.
Well, the cholesterol makes them. So if you don't have cholesterol, you can't make vitamin D, and you can't make the sex hormones, and you can't have healthy cell membranes, and you will be sick.
And
if you had no cholesterol, you'd be dead.
And there's a tendency, I think, to get it too low. Don't a lot of the doctors and the drug companies?
Well, you know, like everything else, if a little is good, a lot more is better. So if a little statin is good, a lot more statin is better. And indeed, if you continue to lower cholesterol levels down to even an LDL level of 60, you're going to reduce your heart attacks and strokes. But what you'll also do is increase your all-cause mortality. So it becomes, an issue that really reflects back on lifestyle. What should we be doing for people who have heart disease or people who are having strokes or other vascular problems? It's about a good diet. It's about healthy exercise. It's about stress reduction, getting enough sleep, not weighing too much, and having a meaningful purpose in our life, and not being exposed to things like toxic exposures, because they cause inflammation, and it's the inflammation that does the damage to our body. That's what's causing the heart attacks and the strokes.
So the most important thing is the healthy lifestyle and cleaning up our environment.
Well, the whole thing is all connected together. That's right. So if we pay attention to that, we wouldn't see all these problems. Because what we see is people who have the higher cholesterols and the higher HDLs. For example, my cholesterol is about 280 when I'm in shape and doing the things that I should be doing exercise-wise, etc. And my HDL runs about 80. That's a wonderful place to be because it gives me all the cholesterol that I need. And it also gives me all the HDL, which is an association, again, with health, with good health. So that's a good place to be. Now, if I had a problem with inflammation and I had lots of LDL cholesterol, which I do, now I'd be in trouble. So you have to recognize that HDL and LDL and total cholesterol are important, but the real factor that's determining what's going on is your state of inflammation. I know when I was fairly ill with something called metallosis, which is too much cobalt in my system from a hip replacement, my normal cholesterol, as I said, was about 280, dropped to under 200, and my HDL, which stayed at normally about 80 to 90, dropped to 32. That was all the effect on the liver of cholesterol production and inflammation. That's a great example to show you that it wasn't that I was having a problem primarily with cholesterol or HDL. The problem was with inflammation, and that's what we should be paying attention to. So this whole topic, HDL is not the boss, even though it generally gives us a good idea of what our state of health is. And if our cholesterol levels are high because we've done a lot to exercise and reduce our stress and have a healthy diet, et cetera, et cetera, it's a good place to be. All right, the lines are open here on Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
We often hear about hospital-acquired infections, and of course nobody wants one of those, but it seems that they're affecting 5% of hospital patients.
That's a staggering number, Vicki.
And many of them are getting these antibiotic-resistant infections, like the MRSA, we call for methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, and also things like C. difficile.
Right.
And 100,000 people die a year. Now, only 7%, they found in a study, of doctors and nurses wash their hands coming in and leaving patients' rooms.
You want to say that again? did you get that right, Vicki? It sounds outrageous.
7% of doctors and nurses wash their hands coming in and leaving patients' rooms. So it's kind of like, well, no wonder we're getting all these infections. So the hospital decided that they were going to do this study, mm-hmm. and they had video cameras, and of course word got around. And when the doctors and nurses found out that there were videos watching them as they were entering and leaving patients' rooms, the amount of times that they washed their hands went up 88%.
Went up to 88%.
So what happened to people's ethics and morals?
Well, see, it tells you that the practice of medicine for 93% of the doctors and nurses, because only 7% wash their hands, is all about them. It's not about their patients. It's all about them. Oh, I'm too busy. I haven't got time. Oh, they won't get an infection. It's not that important. Well, it is that important. And then, of course, when the video camera's on and 88% of these people wash their hands, it's telling you it's all about them. They don't want to get caught. Because let's face it, that is malpractice of the highest order. In fact, it should be a criminal offense.
Course,
there should be
a
prosecution for that.
Of course, too, many times people wash their hands, maybe not in the patient's room when they leave, but when they go into the medicine room or to go into wherever it is.
Well, the whole point is that we need people who care about their patients enough that we don't have to pass legislation to punish them if they don't do what they should be naturally doing because they care.
Well, the other thing that annoyed me was that they spent $50,000 putting up all these cameras. Why not invest that money in putting copper surfaces in the hospital? Because we already know that copper kills the germs.
Well, you need to do both because we
yes.
know we've got people who won't wash their hands if they're not monitored. And the hospital should take responsibility of using copper surfaces on all kinds of things, like bed rails and telephones and computer keyboards and even the floors and everywhere. There.
Where you push on the door to open the door and close the
now,
door.
Now, that would cost a lot of money, but how much? I mean, what we're talking about is people's lives, and it's a one-time thing. And when they did this in ICUs, they found that 97% of the microbes that were in ICU were killed within 90 seconds. By the copper surface. And the rate of infection from MRSA and C. diff went down 40%. Now you're talking about big changes here. And think of the cost, if you just want to be mercenary about it, think of the cost in dollars for one person who has a serious infection that's acquired from the hospital. You're looking at as much as $200,000-$300,000 or more, or $500,000 if they're there for a long time. Some of these people are hospitalized for weeks to months. That's an enormous amount of money. So why not spend that money one time, okay, to fix that room so that it's not so likely to happen again? And then, of course, the cameras are turning out to be absolutely necessary because people are not doing what they should be doing if they're responsible. So this whole system here of how doctors and nurses operate when they're in the hospital needs to be addressed. And I'm afraid what it goes back to is the nature of medical school and nursing school training. Because in those systems, what happens is we get abused big time. The training is militaristic, and we're told what to do. We're not asked what to do. It's legislated, and if we don't do what we're supposed to do, we get in lots of trouble. For example, I was on for 36 hours and off for 12 for weeks at a time. And when I was in that setting, I was so sleepy, so tired, that I got lazy about some things. Everybody did. You almost had to. If we trained our doctors and nurses to be more compassionate because we're more compassionate with them and more understanding, maybe they'd be more responsible when they got out of their training and wouldn't feel so rushed about things and maybe just would be so interested in their patients, which is how they should be anyway, that they automatically would do that. It was like, I mean, I couldn't imagine you, Vicki, when you were practicing as an RN, not washing your hands, because I know you'd come home and I'd see your hands were rough.
They get cracked and everything. No, I never would have even dreamed of touching one patient after I'd touched another one.
That's because you care.
Always wash my hands. And in those days, we weren't having these antibiotic-resistant infections.
No, not so much. At least nobody was reporting them. And look at what you were putting on your hands. You're putting all this toxic stuff.
Five the heck that would try. Well, nowadays they put horrible stuff on their hands. It's like, just use soap and water. They've shown that that is just as effective as these hand washes, these antibacterial hand washes that are creating bacterial resistance
anyway. That's right. That's where a lot of these things come from in the first place. So we should be using only products in the hospital that aren't toxic. I mean, look at all the cleaning agents and the disinfectants and the soaps and detergents that are used and maybe some of the things that are fragrances. These are not things that should be in a hospital. These are toxic.
And nowadays,
people who are in the hospital are toxic to start with, and they need to detoxify, not be toxified worse.
And also, when you were in the hospital, they don't even have a bath basin anymore with a washcloth and a bar of soap. All they have are these packets that you open up that you're supposed to wipe all over your body that are antibacterial.
Well, I just use water. Yeah.
Well,
I mean,
I would think that would invite resistant bacteria.
Well, exactly. I mean, the only thing that will survive in the presence of things like that are the things that are the most resistant. And so, of course, you're going to be selecting out those resistant microbes to be able to live and go on. And they're going to have more surface area to live on. All right. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, here's one that might surprise you that the Canadians have come up with. They're recommending fewer mammograms, no more than every 3 years, and no self-breast exams, and no clinical breast exams.
It sounds ridiculous, doesn't it?
Well, they say that it leads to too much anxiety, false exams, costs, biopsies, the wrong diagnoses, or else maybe even DCIS diagnoses, which... You might want to talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, we'll get to that. The whole point here is the Canadian Task Force on Preventive Healthcare recommends mammograms, like you said, every 3 years now, not every two or every 1 year. And they think that the extra examinations that are done by women on themselves and by doctors or nurses or nurse practitioners leads to finding too many small lumps that lead to unnecessary biopsies, finding of a non-cancerous form of cancer, which is a silly way to look at things, with ductal carcinoma in situ, or DCIS, 2% of the time will kill you, and 98% of the time does nothing. You'll die with it, but not from it. And we wind up treating all those people, because of the fear of the 2%, with radiation, surgery, and chemotherapy. At least that's the recommendation that's made.
And they don't even mention all the radiation that you're getting exposed
to.
No.
So the Canadian Task Force knows what they're talking about. They've made perfect sense here. And United States Preventive Services Task Force recommended that women under the age of 50 only have a mammogram in selected cases. So they said don't routinely screen for it, because it takes 1,800 mammograms to save one life, and you're going to cause cancer after every about 1,000 to 1,200 of them. So you may cause as many as two cancers in that group while you're saving
one
life.
Oh, wow.
So that's, you know, so the biopsies that are unnecessary, the unnecessary surgeries, the unnecessary treatments, the anxiety that goes with it is huge. And so maybe it's just better to take their advice. And the same thing with self-exams. You know, the American College of Radiology took sharp opposition to that. And they said that they thought thousands of women would die with breast cancer because the mammogram screening is so effective. Well, you know, that's a point of view that has not been proven. I'm sorry. The data on that is not all one-sided. You look at both sides. You could also look at what the rest of the world is doing. I mean, the rest of the world isn't doing mammograms on women under the age of 50.
Just because something seems like it's common sense doesn't mean that it's right.
Well, that's right. All right, it's time for your first 2020 tip, Vicki. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. So if you have a question about your health, give us a call, and we'll be taking them after Vicki's first 2020 tip.
Body need milk. Well, it sounds so wholesome and pure and light, and it contains calcium and vitamin D.
Well, the milk people think that.
Yeah, but you know, there is a dark side to drinking milk, and it can actually contain up to 20 different kinds of painkillers, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, antibiotics, growth hormones, I mean, they found medical residues in samples of cow milk, goat milk, and human breast milk from all these chemicals used to treat the animals and human illnesses.
Sounds like the vets are using too much medication. Is that what you're trying to say? Or is this in the water that they're consuming all these drugs?
Yeah.
And so then it's concentrated inside the cow. The next thing you know...
Well, that's why it's also in the goats and in the humans.
Sure. So it's excreted. See, the mammary gland, besides making milk, is also an excretory organ. And it concentrates heavy metals and all these toxins. In fact, if you took milk to the EPA and said, study it, see if it's good for human consumption, the answer would be this stuff is polluted.
Well, they also find, you know, things like other drugs like lipid regulators, the statins, sure, and anti-epileptic drugs, the beta blockers for blood pressure, antibiotics, all kinds of hormones. And the highest quantities were found in the cow's milk. Mm-hmm. And this list doesn't even include the pesticides. And research makes it really clear how prevalent man-made substances like drugs and chemicals really are in our food chain. And so the growth promoting hormones and the drugs that are all given to the cattle and the cows, they're often present with contaminated cattle feed. And some go so far as to say that cow's milk is a tainted bodily fluid from diseased animals that contains a wide range of dangerous disease-causing substances.
Well, that's why we call it an organ of detoxification. So how, until we clean up our environment, we're screwed.
And the cow's milk, both, this will surprise you because it's both regular and organic, has 59 active hormones. And it also has allergens and herbicides and pesticides, lots of dioxins, 200 times the safe level of dioxins, up to 53 powerful antibiotics, blood, pus, species, bacteria, and viruses. Oh, boy, I can't go wait to have a
glass of milk. Are you making it sound appealing?
Well, you know, the growth hormone that's called insulin-like growth factor 1, it's a fuel cell for cancer. Mm-hmm. And it's the key factor in the growth and the proliferation of every breast cancer and also for other cancers like prostate and colon cancers. In fact, it just worsens all cancers. So... milk is, touted to contain lots of calcium, which is one of the ways that they sell it. But, you know, contrary to popular belief, commercially sold milk is not the best way to get calcium. It's actually not bioavailable, and it does not prevent bone loss. And it's actually expedited by consuming an excess of milk. And, one of the reasons is that it has insufficient magnesium to balance it all out. There was also a Harvard study of 78,000 nurses over 12 years that showed that those that drank milk had increased risks of hip fractures, and there was no increase in fractures observed in the same level of calcium from non-dairy sources. So I just want to give you some sources of calcium other than milk. So mm-hmm. you have a choice. I don't like to just leave you with don't do that. You know, like leafy green vegetables and orange and apple juice and beans, rice milk, tempeh, and calcium magnesium supplements. Or a handful of almonds would do that.
Yeah.
And I also want you to be aware about organic raw milk. It has a lot of health benefits with vitamins and amino acids and CLA and omega-6 fatty acids and so forth. And what happens is that pasteurization destroys most of the nutritional value of the milk. And if you put a calf on pasteurized milk, I forget how many weeks it is, but they die from that.
Well, that's an interesting story. I've never seen that original reference. It wouldn't surprise me much because, I mean, there's a big difference between the raw milk and milk that's been heated to high temperatures that destroys a lot of things that will be good for the calf.
Well, we don't heat
mother's milk, do we?
We used to be able to get raw milk in the health food store, and now it's almost impossible to get it.
Well, the FDA is against it,
and they're for pasteurized milk.
Yeah, well, there's a point to be made there because we know that raw milk in some people who are immunocompromised is not a good idea because the microbes that are in there would be things that would be putting people at risk for developing life-threatening infections. So I think the better thing to do is to educate people and say, don't do this if you're immunocompromised, or even put something on the label of the milk itself, but not remove
but
raw milk from us if we want to use it.
If we're not immunocompromised.
Exactly. All right. Thanks for that, Vicki. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. So if you have a question about your health or want to join our conversation, give us a call.
So what about the food in children's hospitals being unhealthy? You know, there was a study in the Academy of Pediatrics showing that 14 major California pediatric hospitals showed 7% of foods were healthy. So, like, what kind of a role model is this? Yeah, 93% is not.
Well, what kinds of problems do you see in it? Things like high fructose corn syrup. There are artificial sweeteners. There are too many carbohydrates. There's too little fiber. It's not organic. There are not enough of vegetables and fruit. All these things should be present in anybody who wants to eat a healthy diet, particularly if you're in the hospital where you need that nutrition. I find it just shocking that the hospital doctors don't know more about nutrition. I found it interesting that this particular study said that MDs know about nutrition, and they shouldn't let these things happen. But my point is with an hour of nutrition in medical school, how the hell are they going to know much about it? And it's just proven, because they sit back and watch this happen. They don't do anything.
Well, the other thing they do is that they have desserts and things with high fructose corn syrup. Yeah. When the visitors go to the cafeteria, they have it right next to the cash register. So at the last minute, you can just be sure to get your dessert.
Well,
and
it just tells you that the hospital administration doesn't give a damn, because they know about it, but they don't do anything. And I know I've spoken with the dietitians at my local hospital and said, why don't you have organic food? They said, we'd love to do that. We would really like to have it, but they won't pay for it. They say it costs too much. And I'm saying, we're spending thousands of dollars every day to be in a hospital, and we can't come up with $5 more to make it organic? And that would be an exaggeration. It wouldn't even be that much. I mean, we're talking about people in a hospital that are sick. They're not doing well.
Well, the food in these hospitals that they checked out said that it was the same as fast food restaurant quality food.
It pretty much is. And a lot of the hospitals have fast food restaurants in them. Things like Burger King and McDonald's and Taco Bell are in the hospital as part of the hospital system. A few years ago, one-third of all the pediatric hospitals had fast food available in the hospital. What kind of a model is that? And then they want to say that, well, doctors really do know nutrition and they wouldn't put up with it, except that, you know, they're stuck with it.
Well, you can see there's conflicts of interest here, too.
Well, they're huge. I mean, even the American Dietetic Association has gone down the tubes. They're a corrupt, bad organization that's now catering to what? The fast food industry. When you read about some of the things that they support, it's like, why do they call themselves dietitians? I mean, that's just crazy. So that's the way it is. So the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls after a short station break. Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Here's one for you. There are 100,000 emergency admissions caused by drugs annually in older patients, and half of those are in patients that are over 80 years of age. And mostly there are four medications that account for these, and that would be Coumadin, insulin, antiplatelet drugs, and oral hypoglycemic drugs.
Yeah, well, see, all these drugs are problematic, and unless they're taken responsibly, and unless patients understand what they are and what they do, and unless they have enough supervision, you get into trouble with them. I mean, look at a drug like Coumadin. You know, there's an anticoagulant, or it's called warfarin as well. You take too much of that, you're going to bleed. You have some kind of minor trauma to your body. you may bleed out, and
it's
if you're older.
It's not a medication to mess around with. It's required that you get blood work done every certain amount of time, and you have to get that blood work done.
Well, a lot of people don't, and they don't understand how dangerous it is. And you look at insulin. Well, of course, insulin can be a problem because it can make you hypoglycemic. It can drop your blood level to of glucose below 30 or 20, and you can wind up with seizures and brain damage and even die from it. And then you look at the antiplatelet drugs, you know, things like aspirin and Plavix. Those are not safe drugs. They're dangerous. A lot of people die from these drugs.
Yeah, just listen to the ads on TV, and they'll tell you all the things wrong with it.
If that doesn't scare you, it should. So if you're talking about taking those, I would say I would have strong consideration for switching over to fish oil. I mean, fish oil is a great antiplatelet drug. I know it works because I've looked at live blood cell analysis on myself when I was hypercoagulable because of cobalt poisoning from my hip prosthesis. And the cobalt causes a lot of clumping. When you look at a live blood cell analysis, which is basically a drop of living blood that's put in a dark field microscope and multiplied in its power to 8,000 times, you can see what's going on there. And I literally had clumps of 500 red cells sticking together and lots of fibrin there. Because one of the things that cobalt does is it causes severe hypercoagulation, and it causes a lot of fibrosis. You could see why it would when you look at this. So I would take some fish oil after that and look at it an hour later, and it looked like a normal young person's blood. Nice floating red cells, all independent.
And yet the MDs don't normally recommend that. They're starting to, but not. And also the nattokinase, that also helps your blood.
They don't even know what that is. And unfortunately, that's a supplement that's extremely safe and extremely powerful.
Well, let's talk about what it is for our listeners. If the doctors don't know what it is, some of our listeners might not know what
it is. Well, it's a soy product. And what they do is they just take soy, they incubate it with it's a bacillus called I forgot what the name of the bacillus is. I think it's called natto. And it's concocted that way, and it makes an enzyme called nattokinase. And you take the nattokinase out, you extract that out, and what it does is it works to fight against our clotting mechanism. So it's an anti-fibrinolytic agent. So it actually causes your fibrin to not be so prominent and not clot so many red cells and platelets together.
So when you take things that are natural, like the nattokinase and the fish oil, you're not apt to get side effects.
Not likely to. I mean, they're pretty rare.
You probably don't want to take it before you have surgery.
You probably don't want to do that, and I wouldn't either. That. But, I think probably taking a gram of fish oil the day before surgery, unless you're talking about a very vascular operation that bleeds a lot, probably be a good idea. But I wouldn't suggest you do that until we have the tests. What we need to do is have comparative studies done.
The trouble is nobody wants to fund the studies for natural supplements.
Well, Big Pharma doesn't want you to fund it.
But Big Pharma does have one particular fish oil that it sells.
It's called Omicar, and they're kind of getting with it because they say it's more pharmaceutical grade, and it probably is. And that's
whatever
okay.
That means. What does that mean?
It means it's pure. It's not going to have as many impurities in it. Things like the heavy metals. Yeah, probably not. But it costs you an arm and a leg, too. You know, you could just eat fish. That's probably the safest thing to do, have fish a couple times a week.
But there are some brands, I don't know what they are, but I know that there are some brands of fish oil that do take the mercury out.
Well, if you taste the fish oil, it doesn't taste good. Yeah, not just fishy, but not good. That's a problem. If it's dark, that might be a problem. But there's so many good companies that are making that or krill. You know, krill doesn't have the heavy metal problem. It's a little more expensive, but it does the trick. But what we need are comparative studies. I'd like to see a study done with Coumadin, Plavix, aspirin, fish oil, nattokinase, and something called lumbrokinase, and see what the difference is by looking at live blood cell analyses to see what is actually happening visually. And if you do that and you know that it's better, then you don't need to use things that are dangerous, like relatively aspirin or Plavix. And that's why for primary prevention of heart disease and stroke, nobody's recommending aspirin except those doctors that haven't kept up with the literature.
And Coumadin can have side effects.
Coumadin is the worst of them all. I mean, you're going to get osteoporosis after a couple of years. You're also going to wind up with more arteriosclerosis after about 3 years and more aortic valve calcifications. Coumadin is a dangerous drug.
And it's rat poison is what it is.
Well, it's that too, and that's a little unfair because they're giving him an enormous dose of Coumadin. But even taken absolutely perfect, it's going to increase your risk for heart disease, heart attacks and strokes within 3 years.
Even though some people are taking it to prevent strokes, huh?
Well, that's right. It prevents some of the clotting part, but it doesn't prevent the calcification part.
You could talk to your doctor about trying fish oil and some of these other things instead, like the natokinase.
Well, they're not going to know much about it, and they're going to be scared to do it. Because if they do and somebody has a problem, they're going to be liable for it. So they're playing CYA. They don't want to get into trouble.
Well, but what if you asked your doctor and said you want to keep doing the blood tests as you normally do, and they could tell from that if it was working, couldn't they?
Well, yeah, but if there's a problem from it, there aren't very many studies that show that it's the right thing to do. That's why I say we need comparative studies.
Well, you kind of did your own little brief study on yourself.
Oh, for sure I did, yeah. And there was no way I was going to take Coumadin after having
Well, that's the other thing that's too bad is that doctors don't do live blood cell analysis.
Well, they don't understand it.
Why? It seems like it's just common sense, straightforward. You just watch your blood while it's alive moving around and see what's going on in there.
Well, you're right. But it's still not the standard of practice. And if something goes wrong that's not even related to it, you're going to have a problem. Anyway, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's final 2020 tip.
I have an oldie but goodie. You may have heard this before, but if you haven't heard it before, and even if you have heard it again, it's good for a laugh, and laughter's the best medicine.
All right. Spit it
out. So there are three women and two younger and one senior citizen sitting naked in a sauna. And suddenly there was this beep, 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 beep. And one young woman pressed her forearm and the beep stopped. Well, the others looked at her questioningly, and she says, "That was my pager. I have a microchip under the skin of my arm."
Oh, geez.
So a few minutes later, a phone rang, and the second young woman lifted her palm to her ear. And when she finished, she said, "That was my mobile phone. I have a microchip in my hand."
Jeez.
So the older woman felt very low-tech, and not to be outdone, she decided she had to do something just as impressive. So she steps out of the sauna, goes to the bathroom, and comes back with a piece of toilet paper hanging from her rear end. Well, the others are raising their eyebrows and staring at her, and the older woman finally says, "Well, will you look at that? I'm getting a fax."
Oh, jeez. Oh, my God, Vicki. That's Nurse Vicki for you. All right, the lines are open. The number is 888-874-4888.
What's going on that 10% of patients with stents are being readmitted to the hospital within a month, and they're more likely to die within a year?
Well, there it is. I mean, those are the stats, and you're right.
You know, we talked a while back about stents and how it's really not advisable to have a stent put in unless you really have had a heart attack.
They're way overdone. Unless you're having acute coronary insufficiency, which means you have angina that's so unstable that your risk for a heart attack goes way up, or you're having a heart attack, a stent is the wrong treatment. And a lot of the time, because it seems so logical, you've got a block, stick in a stent. You'll do better.
Let's talk about what a stent is.
Well, it's just a way of opening up an artery using a little device that can be put in by putting a catheter in the aorta and threading it up to the coronary arteries and putting it in the coronary arteries under a CT scanning device and then putting that little expandable piece of metal where the blockage is, and it expands, and all of a sudden you have an opening there where you didn't have much of one before.
So it sounds good. It sounds great.
It just makes a lot of sense.
But there can be complications. Can't you develop clots in that area?
Lots of problems. You know, it reminds me of a patient in 1970. I still remember this. This was 41 years ago. was one of my first patients.
Were they doing stents then?
I remember her name. Her name was Ruby. She was 37. She had hypertension that wasn't well controlled, and she was having chest pain. She had six little kids, all of the age of 14, and married to a great guy. And her chest pain was severe. She had an electrocardiogram that was diagnostic of a heart attack. And because we were just learning how to do bypass operations at that time, I referred her to Stanford, where they did the operations, and she died on the table.
Aww.
Okay? Six little kids.
Mm.
I get haunted by that still today.
It wasn't your fault.
No, it wasn't. But, I mean, if I hadn't referred her, she might still be alive today.
You thought it was the best thing.
Yeah, well, a lot of the time, we think things are the best thing.
Yeah.
And so we do that. Because we think that that's going to potentially help or save the life of our patient.
Do you know exactly what it was that killed her?
She had clots. Okay, they all clotted. And so she wound up just dying. And she died right there on the table. They couldn't do anything to save her.
I've heard that now sometimes they put anticoagulants on the stents when they put them in.
Yeah, they don't seem to do a whole lot better. And you just have to keep in mind that we need to practice prevention. We need to do lifestyle medicine. We need to not develop these plaques in the first place. And what do our doctors do? They mention that lifestyle is important. Oh, you need to lose weight. You need to be on this diet. You need to reduce the stress in your life. You need to get more sleep. You need to do all the things that you need to do to be relaxed. You need to avoid being around toxic things. Well, what do we do in the way of programs to help people do that? Because...
Or spending the time by just looking them in the eye and letting them know how important it really is.
Well, really emphasize that, but instead what happens, because the doctors know the patients aren't going to follow that advice. They're not going to get on a healthy diet. They're not going to exercise. They're not going to sustain all these things. And why? Because they aren't used to it. And they don't really, it's hard for them to change their ways. So what we need is healthcare reform. I mean real healthcare reform, where we're doing wellness and prevention as our basic thing, as primary care, which is, of course, what it should be and what our naturopaths are teaching us to do. We need healthcare reform at the national level and at the local level. So we have programs that people can get into where they have the support of a group and people are all going along with the program. That will stick. And, of course, that's something that we should be doing.
Well, other things that can happen when they're having a stent put in, because I think people do need to be aware of complications, is bleeding. I guess they could probably perforate that artery.
That's why
too.
Whenever a cardiologist is putting in a stent, there's a heart surgeon standing by to take them right to surgery now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the safest thing in the world to do. And the data shows that if you're not in an acute setting, don't do a stent. Even though the logic is so persuasive that doctors very often say, well, let's not take any chances. Let's make sure that thing is open. But the data shows that about 3% of the time, it's a value. The other 97% of the time, you're exposing somebody to a procedure that can be lethal because it has side effects and complications. And that's not indicated. The medical treatment works just as well. And, of course, the lifestyle treatment is the answer. But we don't do that.
Well, the other thing that's happening is that they're being discharged too soon.
That's right. With the HMOs being interested in containing costs, you know, and making sure that we don't waste any funds at all, they're sending people home a lot sooner than they did years ago. Now, I may have kept my patients in the hospital 20 years ago a little longer than some others did. But you know what? They hardly ever came back. Hardly ever came back. They did super well. It might have cost a little bit more in terms of the short term, but in the long term, it was cheaper because you readmit somebody with a complication, you're talking about something that's a big deal, and it may cost $100,000 or $200,000 or $500,000. A lot better to keep people a couple days longer than it is to run the risk of the complications, both from the point of view of the money, but also of the patient.
So do you know what the statistics are of these patients that are readmitted to the hospital and what their complications are?
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, 7 or 8% die in a year, and 7 to 30% with severe heart attacks are readmitted after a stent within a year, and their death rate is 40% higher. But maybe it's because they're a little bit sicker and there have been hospital errors. Who knows? But those statistics are scary. So we should be doing everything we can to put the patient first. rather than the economics first.
So anyway, if you haven't had a heart attack and you're not in a really serious position that way, it might be better to tell the doctor that you want to think it over some more about getting a stent.
Or get a second opinion.
Yeah, go to our site and read about it on drsaputo.com. Hear us about it.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, either audio or most of it's video now. In fact, we don't do any more audio. It's all
video.
We
have 2,000 audio and videos on our website, drsaputo.com.
Yeah. Right. It's a free site, by the way, for those of you that don't know that, although all of you that are listening are on the site already, and some of you, are listening through PRN Radio.
Well, you know, there's been more news that's been coming up again about this problem you had with your hip, and you were one of the 92,000 people that got metallosis from hip.
Well, we don't know that, but we know that about 15%. 12% maybe of people who have a metal-on-metal hip replacement. That means that the cup and the ball itself have been replaced. And usually it's with titanium on both sides and also chromium and cobalt coating it because it makes it last a little bit longer. But if that joint isn't seated perfectly, it starts to wear it out. And as it does, there are little filings of cobalt and chromium that are put in the local tissues around the joint. And when that happens in 12 to 15%, you wind up seeing inflammation and fibrosis and scarring around the joint that destroys the tissues around the joint big time. And you have a systemic problem because your cobalt levels may go up 10, 15, 20, or 50, or 100 times above what's normal. And the mainstream doctors haven't yet figured it out. They're not cellular biochemists. They figure that until they see some symptoms from the cobalt levels that are high, they're not going to do anything about it. But if you think about it with your common sense, if you've got 10 or 50 or 100 times more cobalt in every cell in your body and every centimeter of your or cc of your blood and tissue fluids, you think that might just have a small impact on what happens.
But they still ignored it in you.
Well, they did. Okay. They didn't know any better. And it's because they weren't paying attention to the literature. When you have a company like Johnson & Johnson, who makes the DePuy hip, have 93,000 recalls, you can bet your life that the attorneys are going to have a ball with a class action lawsuit, which is what's happening now, against the company for doing this.
And this is good information for people to have, because I'll bet you that everybody that's listening to this show knows somebody who's had a hip replacement hadn't had one themselves.
Well, there are 270,000 hip replacements every year. So over a period of 4 years, you're looking at a million people with hip replacements.
So people are going to say, so what's the solution?
Well, I mean, the FDA needs to do a better job, and they've admitted it themselves. They didn't screen these things carefully. They should have, of course, but they must have fast-tracked it or done something to go along with the manufacturer. I mean, you have to remember that 33% of the income of the FDA comes from Big Pharma and the companies that make products.
Medical devices.
I mean, that's a big deal. And about a quarter of the people that are on the FDA committees are what? People from Big Pharma and from the medical technology industry. And they're getting a vote. I mean, how outrageous can it get? They get a vote. Now, I could see getting their input, but I can't see giving them a vote because you know what they're going to do.
It's a big conflict of interest. It's too big.
Well, that's why things like this happen.
But they get by with it.
Well, they shouldn't.
Okay, so what else could people get besides metal on metal?
Well, you can get others that don't do that. You can get one that has a polyethylene coating over one of the surfaces, which is what I have now.
Of course, plastic's not such a healthy thing to have in your body either.
No, it's not, but it's better than the metal on the metal, and it's not like I think it's an ideal solution. And then you can use things that are made of ceramic. You know, you can have a ceramic ball on a ceramic socket.
Could just think if you broke ceramic, what would happen to it?
Oh, boy, you got a big problem.
It's shatter just all over,
it's
huh?
like dropping a piece of china on concrete. You're going to have a problem.
Talk about osteoporosis.
Well, what's the best thing to do? Don't get osteoarthritis. You know, I probably got it because of my tennis.
I
played senior tennis professionally for about 25 years. And I don't know any tennis players that haven't had some kind of replacement, either a knee or a hip or a shoulder. Yeah. So, I mean, a little bit more common sense in how we exercise would be a good idea, too.
We should have more grass courts.
Well, that and play. You know, we're playing on all these hard concrete or asphalt surfaces that really raise hell with the body. So the new hip implants are no better than the older ones. And the metallosis that's occurring from it needs to be highlighted. I think if you've had a diffuse hip or one like I did, I had a Birmingham resurfacing replacement done, which should have been a really great idea.
Within a year.
Yeah, well, within 11 months it went bad. I couldn't even walk. I mean, I was back on crutches again by 11 months. We've got a problem that we have to rectify.
So people need to be aware of this and spread the news. And if anybody wants to learn more about it, it's on our website, drsaputo.com.
Yeah, sure. And if you have pain in your hip and you had these metal things done, these implants done, you should have a serum cobalt and a serum chromium drawn, because you may be one of those people that has that problem. I'd have to suspect that almost everybody who has an artificial hip that's metal on metal is going to have a problem with heavy metal or with these kinds of metal toxicities. So they wear out in 15 or 20 or 25 years. And when they wear out, what do you think has happened? Well, they've ground the joint down so that it's loosening, or it may be unstable. There may be other kinds of mechanical failures. And you're going to have levels of cobalt and chromium that are going to be too high. So this is not a small thing. It shouldn't be taken for granted. Just because you don't have any pain at all doesn't mean you don't have a problem. And I think it'd be worth it to have your doctor, your orthopedist or your family doctor or your internist, go ahead and just measure a level of cobalt and chromium and see where you are. Because if it's high, even if you have no symptoms, you're using up your wellness buffer. You're using up that reserve that you have that keeps you from having symptoms.
Now, what can people do, like you, that have cobalt toxicity, or also called metallosis? Mm-hmm. What can you do? Are there supplements and things that people could take?
Not really, because these are water-soluble metals, okay? And so you should drink a lot of water. That'll wash it out. Just taking my hip joint out dropped my level from 10 times above normal to 5 times above normal. That's a big change. And that was in a month. So I would suspect that in a period of a year or two, most of the cobalt that's been poisoning me will be out of my body. And what kinds of things does acute cobalt toxicity do? It can give you a cardiomyopathy, which fortunately I don't have. It can cause peripheral neuropathies, which I do have. It can cause problems with hypercoagulable blood, which I have. And it can cause problems with your thyroid, which I developed since that time as well.
I thought you got over the neuropathy.
It's still in my little fingers. The ulnar nerve is still involved. I had a neuropathy from another cause when I had my first hip done.
But that was
a different issue. But with cobalt toxicity, these are the things that you see. And so I feel the book. I feel
so
the
it's
picture.
It's hard to get beautiful. Rid of it because the cobalt is still there. It keeps.
It's still in its issues around. It's going to take months to years for that to wash out. And of course, all the systemic toxicity, it will gradually disappear as well. But it's going to take time. It's just going to take time. So I'm drinking a lot of water, and I'm eating healthy food. I'm not trying to eat anything that's got toxic things in it. And that's how it goes. Well, we got time for just another short one, Vicki.
You know, people with low blood levels of vitamin D, boosting them with supplements more than halve the person's risk of dying from any cause compared to somebody who remained deficient. And researchers found that 70% who were deficient in vitamin D were at a significantly higher risk for a variety of heart diseases.
Yeah, well, this is a big deal that we're learning a lot about. You know, we know there's an epidemic of vitamin D deficiency. But what we don't have data on is what happens if we fix it by taking a supplement. Will that change the diseases that were caused? Things like hypertension and diabetes and heart attacks and strokes, the propensity to develop cancer and osteoporosis. Is that going to do any good? And the answer for osteoporosis we know is definitely it's going to do some good, because, I mean, I've done that study myself in my office, and what we see is an awful lot of people who are getting rid of their osteopenia and their osteoporosis is getting better on a few simple things that center around vitamin D, vitamin K, and a little bit of calcium. And sometimes a little bit of strontium to help lay it down. But in the case of heart disease, there's been no data to show that if you have heart disease, can you actually reverse it by if you have a low vitamin D by increasing the amount that you take? And the answer is yes. So now we know it, and everybody should have a vitamin D level measured, because it's absolutely critical that we know what it is so that we can replace it to a normal level. And of course, the smartest thing to do is what?
Get out in the sun and have some fun.
Of course. And in the wintertime, when you can't get much vitamin D, except maybe on a day like today, which is really a beauty, you might get some, and only between the hours of 10 and 2, because that's when UVB light comes through. And if it doesn't come through, then the problem is that you can't get it, so you have to supplement. And that's the way it is. So we're at the end of another show. I want to thank you all for joining us. And I'd like to remind you that we'll be back live to talk about what's new in the news in health and to take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com from 3 to 4 Eastern Time and from 12 to 1 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be archived on drsaputo.com as well as prn.fm.
And if you've enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. We have a new one that comes up every weekday.
Every single day.
And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
Have a wonderful week. Thanks for joining us.